So last lecture yesterday, what did you? What did we do? I first mentioned Hollevaux's theorem, which is the fact that despite the wave function seem to have an infinite amount of information or an infinite number of bits that you would need to describe alpha and beta, when we do measurements, we get only one bit of info. So that is a qubit that you send to somebody. The person on the other side cannot get more than one bit of information out of it. So that was the first part. And then we talked about a few algorithms. One of them was super dense coding. So anybody remember what super dense coding is? That's it. If Alice and Bob share an entanglement, an entangled state, Alice can do something to her piece, her qubit, and then she sends it to Bob, and then Bob makes a measurement on the belt basis, and he gets two bits of classical info. So this shows one piece, that an entangled state, which is a correlated state between two qubits, is a resource for information processing. Okay. Then we still saw quantum teleportation, okay, which is another protocol. And then Aggie tells me you've heard about quantum teleportation quite a lot, and you'll hear more. And we're going to use it tomorrow in a specific way, and which really gives you an advantage of doing something. And we won't teleport information, we're going to teleport a gate. And the fact that we can do this will make an incredible difference in a particular implementation with linear optics system. So the idea of teleportation is Alice has a state. So she shares one bit of an entangled state with Bob. So she has two qubits, Bob has one. One is her state. Second one is the state, the qubit which is entangled with Bob. She makes a measurement in the belt basis. She sends the result of that belt measurement to Bob. From this, Bob makes a gate, which depends on which is the result of the belt basis in this four possibility. And then Bob gets that state, which appears there. So these, again, it's a little bit surprising, and maybe it's not surprising when you hear enough, but to me it's always surprising because the information or the alpha and the beta of that state never seem to go through space. It, in some sense, reappear there where you do the right thing. So but again, this entanglement is a resource to do a certain process or an information processing task. I did point out a few seconds ago that there seemed to be an infinite amount of information here. And Aggie pointed out to me saying, oh no, it's not really infinite or kind of because you can extract only one piece of information. So she's right. We should say really there's a potential amount of information in this alpha and beta. And this is what we're trying to use in different places. Because if I have a state, you'll never be able, a single one, and you can do whatever you want with it. You'll never find what is alpha and the beta in one shot, so you have to do many shots. In fact, maybe at some point we can, if I give you this piece of information, you would say, oh, then how do we know what is alpha and beta? And it's a process called tomography, if you have many copies of that state. So I have a little machine here who can mix many copies of that state. Then you have a process called state tomography, which kind of can go and find what is the values of alpha and beta, but you'd have to do this process repeatedly. So have you ever heard about state tomography? A few yes,
yeah.
And a few no's. So maybe on the third week, I will add this at some point of how we do this. And sometime after implementation, having done something on implementation is also useful because you'll see it concretely how we can do this.
It seems to me that it's super dense coding and quantum teleportation, they are very much the same.
There are, like, indeed, there's a relation between the two, but here, but they're not exactly the same. They both use entanglement. They do both do an information processing task. But in super dense coding, you want to send classical bits of information from Alice and Bob. And with entanglement, you can do it a little bit better than without entanglement. Here, we want to send a quantum state from Alice to Bob. So that is different. And if the claim that quantum information processing is more powerful than classical information processing, then this thing is something which is a little bit more powerful than a super dense coding by itself, right? Okay, so after that, we went to look at circuit, reversible classical computation, and we'll talk about universality in a second. But we introduced a gate called the Telfer-Lee gate. In fact, we introduce some gates like the classical and or not gate, the fan out, which were not reversible. And then we made a claim that sometime we wanted to have something which is reversible. It came from the work of Landauer and Bennett, thinking about shrinking computers, not dissipating heat. Somebody asked me a question about dissipating heat and entropy. It's called the Landauer principle, that if you have a bit of information at a finite temperature, to erase it and bring it back, it takes kT of energy. And although there's no proof, at least, that satisfies me about this, it's a principle that people have been using. In some specific case, you see that it is indeed the right concept. And indeed, your computers heat up when they do computation. So if you want to do quantum computing, we want to do quantum computing with unitary transformation. Unitary transformation are reversible, so we have to start to think about reversible computation. And then I told you that there is a gate, classical gate, which is universal, which is reversible, which is the Toffoli gate. So this is a gate where if both the first and second bit are one, you do a not on the third bit. Otherwise, if you have a different initial state here, then you don't do anything. Okay. I should also point out that I think in the lecture note and the homework, this symbol is sometimes written as a zero with a cross in it. And it's a bit longer in the blackboard to do this. And so I put an X there. So it's the same gate there. So this gate is a little bit like a generalization of the control knot. Now, is there a homework or tutorial of how we decompose this three-qubit gate into a bunch of two-qubit gates? So you'll look at this. And so on a quantum case, in the classical gate, the classical case, you cannot decompose it with reversible one and two-qubit gate only. So to have something which is reversible classically, you need at least three bits. And the clip of Feynman referred to this implicitly. You'll see in the quantum gate that you can do this. And the interesting thing is when you try to do this, you need to have a square root of an X gate. And do you know what is the square root of an X gate? Okay, so you have a gate. Okay, so you can write X as something like this, right? E to the I pi over 2 X. You expand this, you get cos of pi over 2, which is 0, and sine of pi over 2 times X is a factor of I, that global phase that we don't worry about. So this gives you the X gate. And if you want to do the square root of it, take the square root of this. If you take the square root of this, you have I pi over 4 X. Okay. And so you'll use something like this in winter. OK. Now, when we explain how to use that Toffoli gate to do something like a NOT gate, I told you you can do this by taking the first bit and the second bit equal to 1. And this Toffoli gate is going to give you a NOT gate on the third bit. So So when you want to do reversible computation, you need to carry some extra bits around to do certain things. So there's a bit of sets of bits, I'm going to call them junk bits, that you don't really need for the answers of your computation, but you need to implement them there. You also need to carry a set of, again, junk bits to do certain things. I'll give you an example. If you want to add two numbers, you need to have carryover when you do this. So you remember you add a number with other ones, and you take a carry there. So once you want to, when you want to do your computation, you have these carryover bits. Classically, it doesn't really matter. You can forget about them. But quantum mechanically, these junk bits can get entangled with the rest of your bits, and then you get into trouble. So people started to think, what do you do with these junk bits? And here's the answer to it. So suppose you have a computation needs n bits. You have a bunch of zeros here, and then you do the computation. You get x1, xn. You have to carry what you started with to be reversible. Then you have the answer. Let's say m bits, and then you have a bunch of junk bits of decay. Okay? And you have a computation, which is what Charlie Bennett and colleagues found is that you can always find a way to get rid of these junk bits by doing a little bit more processing. And the question at the time says, how much processing do you want it to do? And if the amount of processing would grow exponentially with the computation that you do, then it tells you that irreversible classical computing is very different than the non-reversible classical computing. And what they found is it is possible by adding a few bits. How many of them is m of them? Start them at zero. Okay. And then as you do a control knot between that bit, all of the bits. Oops. Of your answer, the one which goes up to n, and then you reverse that computation. And because we have a Toffoli gate that does everything, what is the inverse of a Toffoli gate? Okay, I'll make one answer a little bit easier. You have a control knot. So the control knot is, if the bit is zero, you do nothing. Unit transformation, right? If the bit is one, you do x. Okay? So now I've done a control knot between two qubit. Now I want to reverse that. Another control knot? Okay, speak a little bit louder so that.
Another control knot?
Absolutely. You do a second control knot. And then you won't do anything if the state is 0. If the state is 1, you're going to flip it twice. X squared is equal to 1. Then it shouldn't be too hard. What is the inverse of the Toffoli gate? Absolutely. So now we know how the inverse. So if I decompose the circuit with a bunch of Toffoli gate, I can do exactly the same circuit, and then it's going to reverse it. Okay. So I have to put them in an inverse order. That's the only thing. So that the last thing that you do, you have to undo it by a Toffoli gate. Okay. So which tells you that if we started with T gate in here, we'll have to do two T gate to reverse it. But here I have M gate to do the control knot. And this will assure you that you'll go back here to Xn and then zeros. And then your answer is here that you can use in other computation. And so all these bits here, you can use them again in the next part of the computation, whatever you do, and then you carry things around. So with this, you can reverse your computation. Okay? So, and as I said, for quantum computing, this is essential because you don't want your junk bit to come and interfere. It doesn't take much for your quantum computation to go awry. So if you have one bit that you add and it's in the state orthogonal to the other piece of that you want to interfere with, you will not see that interference. So this ensures that this is possible. So in general, you can show that if we can efficiently compute x that goes to f of x, we can efficiently do x, y, 0. And this bracket means classically to x, y, f of x, 0. And this is adjunct. And then quantumly, u bit is the same thing. So we can do our computation efficiently, reversibly, if we know how to do it classically. And we'll see this when we go to the algorithm of Peter, the factoring algorithm of Peter Shor. You'll see example of how we do some of this. Okay. So the last thing I want to do in this direction is in the foundation before going to implementation. Is to talk about quantum universality. We already mentioned a little bit about universal set of gates, a control knot, and a generic, a single qubit gate, a generic one qubit gate works. But for a reason related to fault tolerance, and also to have finite specification for an algorithm, we'd like to have not a continuous set of gates, but a discrete set of gates. Because if I give you a continuous set of gates, maybe to do an angle which is 0.637, 8, 9, 10, and incredibly large would become incredibly, incredibly hard. But if I have a set of discrete gates, I just have to tell you how many times I use these discrete gates. So can we turn our universal set of gates, having a C naught, for example, or it could be another two qubit gate, and the generic rotation to some discrete one? And the answer is yes. And to make that translation, however, we need to show that with this discrete set, we can approximate any state, that any transformation that you want, any kind of generic rotation. And you won't be able to do it exactly, but you'll be doing it approximately, and you want to show that this approximation doesn't take too much resources. So this is what we want to do. In order to do this, we need to define a notion of measure for a circuit. So we say that a set of gates is approximately universal if for any gate u to the n and an epsilon greater than 0, there is a circuit v using gates from the given set so that there's the distance between u and v. V is the approximation. U is what you would like to do. So there is a distance so that the distance between these two, the approximate what you want, is smaller than epsilon, where this is a notion of distance. And I'm going to give you OK, Okay, is some distance, and an example of this distance, this spectral norm, for example, the absolute value of U minus V, which is defined as the max over all states of U minus V, absolute value, on that state. So for any states, you want this distance, the approximate version, the exact of what you want, smaller than this value. So if you can, if you do have this, then you can say that we have an approximate, we have a set of gates which is approximately universal, and there'll be some small errors that comes in there. And with quantum error correction, we will take care of this in the future. Okay? So do we have sets of gates which is that way? And I'm gonna say, I'm just, state it without proving it. It suffices to be able to do rotations around two axes, which are by irrational multiple of pi. Okay. So an example of this set. So because C naught is discrete, we're worried only about a single qubit gate. And I think I've mentioned already that DH, the NMR gate, and the T gate is a set, and with H and T, by doing only these two sets of gates, you can do any rotations. Okay? And in a quantum circuit, I'm gonna write H this way, T this way, for example, and the control knot in this form here. Sometime you'll see, and when we do NMR, the physics in NMR doesn't allow you to implement a control knot directly. You'll have another interaction, which will look like sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma z 2, okay? This comes from the Hamiltonian of the interaction between two nuclear spins. And then I think you have an exercise to show how you transform this to a control knot. So you have to do a set of gates, and you can see that this indeed is some kind of form of control knot, okay? Because this tells you that if you have a state 0 in there, you're going to do a rotation here in a way. And if you have a 1 at the other qubit, you'll do the rotation the other way. So it's a slightly different kind of rotation. It's a rotation of z instead of a rotation of x. But we know how to turn an x into a z, right? How do we do this? Yeah, we do this with NMR. So you'll see this in a little bit more detail. Okay. There is another question that you can start to worry. Suppose that we have this set of universal gate, HT and C naught. And then you have a friend who lives somewhere else and he has another set. Can it be possible that one set is more efficient than another set to do a computation? And the answer is, if you say efficiency is really the number of gate that you do, yeah, sometimes a set might be better for a specific algorithm. But if you define efficiency not as exactly the number, but is the number is going polynomially or exponentially, then you have a difference. You don't have a difference. And there is a theorem, which is called the Solovey-Kitaev theorem, which says, lets you be any unitary acting on order one number of qubit. So, for example, for one qubit gate, but we could do it also for two qubit gate. Consider a universal set of gates that is closed under inverses. Then U can be epsilon approximated. Using order log of 1 epsilon gates from the universal set of gates. And this tells you that it doesn't matter if you use a different universal set of gates. So these things are equivalent with each other. Okay? So this tells you that if you have a circuit with T gates, the number of gates that you will have to do in the other universal set of gate will go like order of t log of t epsilon. So I add this, so with this theorem, you have to say you don't worry which set you will do. And when you go and do implementation, you just go the one, you are gonna go and use the one that your implementation, the one in which is easiest for your parser implementation. And we'll see example of this. And when we do implementation. Okay? Any questions?
Yeah, sorry.
Just 1 second that I bring this thing up.
What's that? Let U be any unitary acting on, and then it's this order
of one.
Order one qubit. Okay. So we've seen a lot of basic pieces of quantum information. And what we're going to do right now is move to implementation. So now we're going to change kind of a little bit of mood and think, how do we have all these ideas of algorithms, we have gates, we have things, how do we build something that will implement these ideas of quantum information processing? Now I'll give two examples, one using photons, one using NMR, and the one with using photons, I'll look at different way of thinking about it, so that I can pick up a few concepts as we do this, and so that you can understand differences. So the one really important thing is how much control and what is the control that we have on our systems. And so to make this a little bit more formal to think about these implementation, there's a set of criteria that have been suggested so that would be sufficient to build a quantum device. And they are called the DiVincenzo criteria. Okay? So, criteria number one, we want to have a scalable system with well-defined qubits. Okay. So, when somebody comes and tells you, I have a quantum computer, the first thing you need to think about is, what are the qubits in that system? So you have a physical system, behave a certain way, quantum mechanically, and you're going to take some degree of freedom of that system, and you'll say, these are my qubits. Okay? Example of this, nuclear magnetic resonance. You have a little magnet inside the nucleus of atoms, magnetic moment. It points up, it's a state zero, point down is one. You can make superposition of both of them. In photons, then photons have polarization, right? So you can have a polarization which is horizontal or vertical. 2 degrees of freedom, you could use that. But you could also use single photons, a photon which goes down one path or a photon going in another path that can be 2 degrees of freedom. You can use this. You could have an atom which has many levels, but you take two of them. And then you say one is the zero, one is the one. Now you have to start to think about what are the other degrees of freedom. Okay? So once you have your qubit, somebody comes and say, I have qubits. And we're going to look at some later on. You need to have an initial state, okay? A well-defined state. So it could be the Boltzmann distribution. It could be the state zero of all my nuclear spins pointing up or down. I'm gonna usually think about only state zeros, which is an abstract, it could be any state. So you have to define one in particular, okay? And your physical system will tell you which state is kind of easy to reach. And for example, if you do nuclear spins or electron spins, you could think about them as cooling down to very low temperature, so they all align. Then you will get something like this. So that defines one. And it's important to define it because you could hide some of the complexity by abstractly thinking that you would get some other states. You say, oh, I'm going to start with this state, which is really hard to reach, and then it wouldn't be surprised that you can solve hard problems with this if magically you have this. So you have to have something that the physics tells you that you can reach these states. Yeah. Okay, we need to have control on these qubits. Okay. And we've already talked about some piece of control. One qubit gate, two qubit gate, a set of universal gates. Okay. And they have to act on these qubits. My first example of implementation will be one where it won't be scalable, but it will be well-defined qubits. And the control will be peculiar. Usually when we think about control, we're thinking that we can have gates which are applied on the qubit themselves. But sometimes you can apply gates on the states. So it doesn't have the tensor product structure. You can do this. I'll give you an example. And then we'll get into trouble in one place. Things will not be scalable. But I want to show you this because my point here is that you really have to understand not only what the control you have, but what is this, its impact on the qubits and how it acts on this. And for quantum computing, we assume that there's a tensor product and the gates act on the qubit in a tensor product form. If you're not totally sure what I'm talking about, you'll see in the next the end of this lecture and the next one, how does that work. Okay, and number four is that you have to be able to do measurement. And typically we'll say we have projective measurements in the state zero or in the state one. Okay, and again, you need to say this explicitly so that you don't hide some of the complexity and some weird measurement that you would not really be able to do. In fact, for photons, we're going to do this. For NMR, we cannot do projective measurement. So we're going to measure things like trace of some other observable, let's say the X operator, and the density matrix. So it's an ensemble measurement. So slightly different. But you need to be able to make some form of measurement. And all the results of the claim that you do depend on this. The fifth criteria, which is a little bit different than those, says there shouldn't be too much noise while you do your quantum computation. So that seems to be an obvious thing. Like if you try to quantum compute and you have your neighbor who's kind of shaking your quantum computer, the chances to get the right result at the end is going to be small. And for most quantum computers, your neighbor doesn't have to do much to make your quantum computation unreliable. We'll address the issues of noise. When we say noise is low, you guys should say to me, how low? And we have an idea of how low this when you do error correction. There will be a threshold value of when error correction is useful and when it is not. And so this can be quantified by the value of the error correction part. But for all devices that we have today, we cannot fulfill all these requirements today. In part because the noise is still a bit too high. Or there's some little piece there which are not totally right. So most people will give you a list and say, yes, I fulfill all these criteria, but it's not totally true, especially in that the part here. Okay. Okay. First implementation. So I'm going to use photons here, and I'm going to introduce them by two operators, NA and a dagger. You've used harmonic oscillator. So this is the creation of a photon. This is the annihilation of a photon. I should be a little bit more precise when I say annihilation and creation of a photon, because the photons have many degrees of freedom. There's a frequency that you have, or wave number. So I should put a K here and say a photon of that frequency. Photons have polarization, so I should put a degree of freedom of horizontal or vertical here. And if I have a little time, I might introduce at some point, show you a paper where they use the polarization for photons. But for most of what I do, I'm not going to put this because it makes too many subscripts to track around, and then I'm going to make some wrong ones, and I'm going to confuse you. I'll also assume that all my photons are the same frequency. You can choose the one you want. So I'm not going to put this. But if I wanted to be very more careful, I would have to add these items. And so once I have photons, I'm going to think about using them, and here's a pictorial way of I'm going to do things. I'm going to think about having them in optic fibers. So I'll have, for my quantum circuit, I will say, oh, things I can put a photon here or a photon there. Or I'm going to go and look at an interferometer, which I can make with optic fibers. And then I'm going to do certain operation on them. I'm first going to limit myself to only linear operation with photons. Now, if you hear this word linear and you go back to the Schrodinger equation, you'll realize that Schrodinger equation is a. So, you guys look very serious. So, this is the Schrodinger equation, right? So, what do we put on the other side? Yeah, I have to speak louder. From here, I hear the. If you guys don't know the Schrodinger equation, then you're in trouble. So what is on the other side?
H.
H and psi. And is this equation linear?
Yes.
OK, what does that mean? It's linear. So I have the solution one. And somebody else gives you solution two. It's linear would mean that there's a solution which is? Okay, so that's pretty easy to see that if this obeys this, this obeys that, this will obey. And this is what gives you the magic of the superposition principle of having these cats being dead and alive at the same time and all of the interference that we see when you do a quantum experiment. Okay, so the Schrodinger equation is linear. When I'm going to go and look at this, I'm going to say, at some point, I use linear transformation or not. And it's not in the Schrodinger picture that I'm thinking or that equation. It's the transformation of these A's and A daggers when I do certain operation, like having a beam splitter or a phase shifter. Okay. I think there's a question on the tutorial of this. If you fail it by now, you've not lessons. You can go and look at it. OK. So what can I do with my photons? And maybe I should back up on one thing. When we have photons, it turns out that it's incredibly hard to make them interact with each other. So you take two beams of light, you make them pass to each other, it goes straight through. There's a tiny, tiny interaction that comes in. Sometimes we put materials that do a little bit of interaction. I'll come back to this either at the end of today or tomorrow and mention it a little bit. But most of it, with photons, we do what is called linear transformation of these A's and the daggers, okay, and which are related to these phase shifters and beam scattering. So I'll have two paths. And what, right now I'm going to use the path degree of freedom to describe my qubit. Okay? And what I have in mind, in fact, is an interferometer. So I assume that you've seen what an interferometer looks like. So you have a, you've seen the LIGO things. Yeah. You should have seen the LIGO things. It's a beautiful experiment. Here we're going to do something slightly different. So you have a beam splitter. Light can go this way or this way. You have mirrors here. Mirrors just reflect the light. And you do this so that at some point things come back together. And then you're going to make some measurement here. In a typical interferometer, you take another beam splitter and you measure here, something here, there. But right now, I don't really care about this. I think about what's happening in here. And I'm going to say there's a state, and I'm trying to get my conversion right. If I have 0 photon that comes here and 1 photon that comes there. And I'm going to write this as 0, 1. This will be my 0 of my qubit. So if the photon is equal, come in here, and maybe I should write this as A2 dagger on the vacuum. I create 1 photon. I make it go here. And then I'll have a state A1 dagger on the vacuum, which I'm going to write in this way. So the degrees of freedom in here are, is there a photon in that path or that path? This will be equal to the 1 of my qubit. So sometimes I might use the word logical state. It's the state of the qubit. The state of qubit is built up of one photon, which can be in one path or the other. And that's how I create my two different states for my qubit. And this, the first implementation I'm going to think about, I'm going to use something called beam splitters. I'm not going to use many of them, and something called a phase shifter, but I'll have only one photon in my whole type of generalized interferometer. Right? So if you tell me, is it scalable? Certainly in the energy and number of photons, the answer is yes, because I have only one photon, so I don't need any more. So suppose that, so when this goes through, before it arrives here, suppose that I put so this the 0 and the 1 is corresponding to the state 0. And if I have the state 1 and 0, that corresponds to the state 1. Suppose before it arrives, I put a little piece of glass. Piece of glass change the phases of that photon. Okay? So a phase shifter take A dagger and transform it as A phi A dagger. Okay? The piece of glass slows down the photons a little bit and compared to one which would not go to a piece of glass. There's a relative phase between the two. That's the physics of this piece. Okay. Now, suppose that you started with this. Okay, a superposition of the photon coming here or the photon coming there, and then suddenly you've put a piece of glass on the way in. Okay, what kind of transformation does that do? So the 0, 1, okay. This is equal to alpha 0, 1 plus beta 1, 0. This gets, and I'm going to write it as alpha A2 dagger. Plus beta A1 dagger. So these are different ways of writing exactly the same thing. But in a different, this is in the qubit space. This is in the K ket space of the photons, and this is in the operator space. And really, I should put on the state of the vacuum here. Okay, so I'm just writing things in different way, and we're gonna jump from one place, one notation or one description to another. But once I have this, and I told you that this is coming here, what I get is alpha a two dagger plus beta a one dagger e to the I phi on the vacuum. Okay, so I can rewrite this. I claim I can rewrite this as e to the minus I phi over 2, e to the I phi z over 2 of alpha 0 q plus beta 1 q. Okay? So the part, I have a phi over 2 so that I have a component which is both. You remember that this is equal to cos of phi over 2, the unit operator, plus I sine phi over 2, the z operator. Okay. So if I multiply this part here, there's a part which will give me alpha 0. And then I have a z, which applies to 0 qubit. What does z operator on the 0 does? So the z operator is equal to 1, 0, minus 1 in the qubit space. And if I have the state which is 0, it is this state here, multiplied to 1, so it doesn't do anything to it. So in front of the 0, this thing will give me I to the phi. Over 2, it's going to cancel this, which is what we see here. When it acts on this one, there'll be a minus there. So it'll be a minus phi, which adds to this, and we get the quantity which is there. Okay? So these things, that's how it works. So what you've learned from this is by putting a piece of glass before the interferometer, or in fact, you could put it in the interferometer, it induces a z rotation if you think about this as a qubit. So we think about that state which goes there, or that state that goes there as two different states, the 0 and the 1. And to do a z rotation in the interferometer, if you want to think about it as a qubit, then you put a piece of glass. Okay, so that's the physics way of implementing the z. Okay, now we're going to do another piece. I told you we had a beam splitter here. What does the beam splitter do? The beam splitter has two entrants, right? I'm going to write it this way. Or you can write it the way I wrote it, was something which is straight. You have some input here. And you, so input, output. Or sometime I'm going to write it in this way. Output. So if I turn this around and make this a little bit bigger, these things and these things are the same. Okay? So the beam splitter takes A1 and A2 dagger and do a linear transformation of it. And the most general linear transformation is like this. So what happens when you have this physically is that you have a photon which can come here, photon who can come here. And when it goes through, then it if you look at the linear combination, let's assume that there's only A1 dagger that came in. It then become a superposition of two terms, A1 and A2 dagger after, which means that photon, in some sense, gets split between there and there. It doesn't get split. It gets in a superposition of two parts. So the photon comes here as a chance, if theta is not 0 or pi over 2, as a probability of going there and a probability of going there. OK? So if I give you the state 0, let's say the photon comes here, is the logical 0, and I tell you that going through this has a probability of getting a superposition of 0 and 1, it looks like a rotation of the state 0q goes to a superposition of 0q and 1q. Suppose that I make it so that it's 50-50 beam splitter, and this would give me a plus. And if you do the math carefully, like you'll get a square root of 2 because you don't want to lose your probability. If I tell you that this goes to this, you'll say, this looks like what kind of gate? That's it. OK? So doing the beam splitter, in fact, doesn't give you a DMR. It gives you a Y rotation. So in the block sphere, the Y rotation changes the state 0 to something which is a superposition. There's a funny thing about the LMR. You remember the LMR is like this. Okay? What is the determinant of that transformation? The determinant. Multiply this by this. Minus 1. Minus the inverse. Minus 1. And then there's a factor of 2 that comes in. So you get something which is minus 2 over square root of 2. Oh, it's multiplied twice, so this is divided by 2, it goes to minus 1. Okay? Determinant is minus 1. If I tell you you do 1 qubit rotation, which is of the form e to the I theta over 2 n dot sigma, there's a limit of this, okay, at theta equal to 0, which is doing nothing. And the determinant is 1. And then you do thing which is continuous, and you cannot change the determinant to something which is negative. So you can never really do LMR. The best you can do is an LMR up to a phase, which will take care of this minus. So this is a global phase. Usually we forget the global phase. So we're going to continue to do LMRs by doing Y rotation. So if you do a Y rotation in the block sphere by an angle of pi over 2, in the block sphere, so it's a pi over 4 rotation in here. And then this is ny is equal to 1, and x is equal to 0, and then z is equal to 0. This is like the poor man, poor woman's LMR transform. The poor person in the lab was able to do this. So this was a little side for your culture. OK, so by doing this, we're really doing a Y rotation. And depending if the angle theta here is pi over 4, or this is a 45 beam splitter, so you have half of the probability going there, half of going there. But if you continue this, it's like having a rotation of Y, which goes from zero angle around Y, or different type of angle up to pi. Okay, so that beam splitter is doing a Y rotation, OK? And then we had here that we could do Z rotation, OK? So how do you do? Are we good as a universal set of gates? Yeah. And so here's a question for next. I'm not sure if it's in the tutorial. If I give you a Y rotation, I give you a Z rotation, how do you do an X rotation? Well, it's just a little geometry thing that you can figure out. If you figure this out, it'll be useful for the NMR version. Okay. if we have Y rotation, we have X rotation, and we have qubits. Oh, I didn't mention measurement. So what do we do with measurements? Well, we take photon detectors here, and they detect if you have a 0 and 1. Okay, so if you have put your detector here or here, you'll see if the photon has come from here or if the photon has come from there, then you'll be able to distinguish the state 0 and the state 1. So we have qubits, we have gates, we have measurements. Initial state, you decide if you want your photon to come here or to come from there. That's how you decide. So we're pretty good. Noise. You hope your interferometer is very stable. Depending what you want to do, you can make it on these tables which don't vibrate very much, and you want to have your beam spreader which are really very high transmissivity, and you don't have loss in there, and that people can do this with a small, relatively small interferometer. Now, how do we scale? And why this approach was used? Because there's a theorem by Reck et al. And something in PRL 7358-1998, which say that we can do any operation, any unitary transformation in that funny space with only beam splitters and phase shifters. Yeah. And it's a funny big interferometer. And I'm going to try to make the picture so that what the okay. At every intersection of that diagram, there's a beam splitter. At every line, you can put a phase shifter. And here you have the photon can come in here, it can come from here, it can come from this. And this corresponds to the state 1, 0, 0, 0. 0, 0, 0, this one will correspond to 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1, etc. Okay? And here, the challenge is that to do a 1 to 2 to the n, thing, the number will send only one photon in all of those, which correspond to all the states, but we will now have to have an interferometer with 2 to the n input in there. And the way we act on this is not through a tensor product, but through acting on each state that happens on the system. And this will makes things such that we don't know how it is scalable. We can still do some quantum computation, but we don't know how to make this in an efficient way. So there is a paper of how to implement this idea, implement quantum teleportation with this idea. And maybe at the beginning of next lecture, I'm going to bring this in. I have just a few minutes, and I'm going to give you a piece of homework which will be part of the tutorial, give you a hint of how to do it. Because it turns out that although this is not scalable, so you cannot think about building your whole quantum computer, there are pieces of this that you can use. Yeah? And so here's one circuit that you can go and work on. Suppose that you have an input in here. So you have three beam splitter. You will start with zero photon here, one photon here. Okay? And you're gonna go at some point, you're gonna make a measurement here with we'll look at when there's one photon here and one photon here. What happened to that state at the top? And we'll do something a little bit unusual. That up to now, I told you, you're going to restrict yourself to have only one photon in this whole interferometer. Here, we're going to look at a state which is of the form alpha, no photon, plus beta, a1 dagger, plus gamma, a1 dagger squared. So there'll be a superposition of having zero photon, one photon, and two photons. We're going to go through this interferometer, and then we're going to make the measurement of when and there's one photon here, so this is a dagger here, and here it's zero, so there's no a3 dagger that comes in there. So how do you go and calculate this? So there's a phase here, and in the exercise, you have the value of theta 1, theta 2, theta 3, and phi 1, phi 2, phi 3 are equal to 0. T1, theta 3 is equal to 22.5 degree, and theta 2 is equal to 55.5 degree. So what you do is you write this all in your creation and annihilation operator. Okay? So as you start, you'll get something which is alpha plus beta A1 dagger plus gamma A1 dagger squared, which multiply A2 dagger because there's a photon here, and you don't have any A3 dagger that comes in there because there's no photon. And then you have a phase shifter. So what the phase shifter does? It takes the A dagger and apply it here. So after the A phase shifter, this term and this term will get some phis. This one, there's only one A dagger. So it'll be beta, A to the I phi, A1 dagger, plus gamma, E to the I 2 phi, because it's the square, A1 dagger. A2 dagger. Okay. Now the second step is to go through that beam splitter. So you have a relationship that I put in here. You'll replace A1 and A2 by A2 and A3. You'll get a relationship of what the A2 goes to in terms of A2 prime and A3 prime, and you're going to replace this piece here. Okay? It doesn't affect that one, A1 in there. But when you arrive here, then you have the A1 and the A2 that comes in. And you're going to do this, so you get a long polynomial. It looks really messy. And then when you arrive at the end, you'll look for the coefficient where you have an A2 dagger and no A3 dagger. And you'll look at what happened to the A1 term. And you'll get an answer. And we're going to use this a little bit later. OK, I run out of time. So.
Yeah, I'm not sure I got the idea. What does the theory imply, like, and how exactly it says, like with this instrument?
So speak louder.
Yeah, what's the theorem? What does it exactly say?
Oh, the theorem says that out of phase shifters and beam splitters, I can create any unitary transformation. Okay? And here's roughly how you prove this. You have a unitary transformation, a bunch of terms, which will be a 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix. Okay? If you use a beam splitter, you can take the bottom four element, and by using a beam splitter which acts on the last state and the one before, and you can diagonalize this piece. It's a little bit like a Gaussian elimination. And by doing this, you'll get rid of this term here, which will become zero, and doing this. So that's one of these beam splitter. And then you're going to use the other beam splitter to get rid of the next term of the half diagonal terms. You're going to do this again and again until the bottom row and the last one here have all zeros, except the diagonal. And then you're going to do this then and after. And you'll do this until the term that you have as only phases in the middle, and you're going to use these phase shifters to take care of those. So that's how to do this. Now, the amount of beam splitters that you need in general will grow up like 2 to the n. So that's exponentially hard. And this is what, now, this is not surprising that the generic unitary transformation, if you break it down in 1 n³ gates, will take you an exponential amount of resources. But here, even some example of simple things will take you a lot of steps. So you had to do the Adamar transform in your tutorial, right? That if you do start with the state 0, 0, 0, and you do Adamar on the first qubit, Adamar on the third qubit, Adamar on the n qubit, and you go and look at the superposition here, will be the superposition 0 + 1 for each of the qubit. And if you put all this together, this gives you the superposition 0, 0, 0 + 0, 1 + 1, 0 + up to 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. The number of states that you have here is 2 to the n, but you've done only n operation. And this is a bit surprising that you kind of can spread this. So you've gone through a big part of the Hilbert space by not doing too much effort. And that's a little bit of a hint why quantum computing might help you, that somebody can do this. If you try to do the same thing here, to do many Adamars, then you'll need 2 to the n beam splitters to make this happen. OK, I've run out of time. I'm going to stop there.